You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a society that prizes freedom of speech, where do we draw the line? Is it all right to joke about 9/11, AIDS, and racism? What about rape or child molestation? What's the difference between topics considered provocative, controversial, or taboo, and those that are simply in bad taste? The Last Laugh, a new documentary from Fern Perlstein, looks at comedy through the lens of the Holocaust, weaving together interviews with comedians like Mel Brooks, Sarah Silverman, Gilbert Gottfried, and two of my next guests, with intimate portraits of Auschwitz survivors and rare footage of cabarets inside the concentration camps. It opens this Friday at Lincoln Plaza Cinema, and I'm very pleased to welcome writer and director Fern Perlstein, along with comedian Judy Gold and veteran comedy writer Alan Zweibel, who returns to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Fern, with a marked rise in anti-Semitic incidents and attacks on Jewish organizations, cemeteries, and the like, and since the recent election, your film couldn't be more timely. What are the origins of the idea? What drew you to this subject in the first place?
I've been working on this project pretty much. The germ of the idea came in 1990. A friend of mine and I were speaking to a survivor about Mouse, Art Spiegelman's Mouse, that had just come out. And we got into this very serious and thoughtful conversation, and she was very upset about it. Hadn't read it, but thought, you know, she said to us, you know, there's nothing funny about the Holocaust. You can't cover it in the funny pages. And we said, well, you know, there's nothing funny about Mouse, but we talked about it. And then my friend and I went off in our separate directions, and I went off to film school at Stanford, and he went to get his PhD, and along the way wrote this paper, The Last Laugh, Humor in the Holocaust, and handed it to me in 1993 and said, make this into a movie. That dealt with World War II stuff. And so,
That person wasn't alone in being confused about Mouse. My producer at the time, not the one I have now, thank you, she said, we can't put a comic book on this show. And I got down on my hands and knees, the only time I've ever done it, and said, please, can we? Of course, then it went on to win the Pulitzer.
Right.
It's a classic.
Exactly.
In the film, Mel Brooks, who directed The Producers in 1968, recounts telling jokes about Nazis at Jewish resorts in the Catskills in 1948, and yet to this day he won't tell a joke about the Holocaust. Now, what's the difference in his mind?
It's the difference between making jokes about the perpetrators or the victims.
Alan and Judy, does every comic and comic writer have a line that they won't cross? Alan?
It depends on the forum. I think we don't have lines with each other.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, there's stuff that we tell each other, just like, you know, locker room stuff, you know, stuff, fraternity stuff, stuff that...
But we can say it on the air?
Pardon?
We can still say it on the air.
Well, you can and become president as well.
You know, the fact is, gallows humor, if you want to call it that, or anything that's in bad taste, it's been around forever. You know, anytime there's a national tragedy, even 2001, within hours.
Yes.
From Wall Street, there was jokes being faxed mm-hmm. all over the place about it. So it's a matter, I think, that who you tell it to, under what circumstances. I also think timing has something to do with it. Well, but I also think it better be funny.
Right. So
go ahead. I just want to do a follow-up to that. Well, you're writing often for other people. So would your sense of limits be different than somebody you're writing for?
Well, that's interesting. If I were writing a script for somebody and they requested, or the story seems like it could use a joke like that, a joke of any one of those genres, I would test it out. The fact is, once again, it's who's saying it. If it's in the context of a story, of a script, who's saying it, and is it allowable? You know, if it comes off one way, it's funny. If it comes off another way, boy, that's in bad taste.
Judy?
You know, there's that the term too soon. And I think with comedians, nothing is too soon. And I totally agree with Alan. You know, it's the way we think. We think, where's the joke, no matter what the situation is. And we do speak to one another differently than we speak to, as we say, civilians. Because
are you testing out material when you're doing that?
I think it's the way we communicate. And it's, oh yeah, you got that. I got that. It's really the way that we think, and it's involuntary.
And yeah, not only do I agree with that, I think that there's a code amongst us knowing, wow, this is really naughty. We shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
But listen to this, okay?
Right.
And then it becomes a matter of, all right, who do you tell? You know, we're all hoping that the other one will tell all their comic friends.
Right.
That, oh, look what Alan just, I heard this funny thing that Alan wrote.
Right.
But God forbid if it got out into the mainstream.
Forget
it. You know, that's right.
And you want that adoration. There's nothing like, for a comedian, there's nothing like another comedian laughing at your material.
Fern, Judy mentioned the time. There's a saying, tragedy plus time equals comedy, and that's
discussed
a number of times in the film. How does a comic know when it's the right time to tell a joke?
Well, see, I think that that's a question for them. But, you know, the interesting thing about time is even from when I first tried to make the film in the 90s, the time that it's, you know, taken till I actually got the funding and made it has made it allowable to make this film in a different way.
The reason I ask you is because humor was used as a coping tool among the victims of Nazi Germany.
Okay. So there are so many people I've spoken to, either children of survivors or survivors, who talk about how if you were funny before the camps, you'd be funny in the camps. I mean, that's your nature, you're going to be that person to sort of, even if it's got to be more subtle or so. I think that there are still those people that, you know, had that comic thing, and they still do that too soon thing, you know?
You know, it's interesting because even to this very day, when I'm telling people, if I write them an email telling them about the opening of your movie, okay, and if I tell them what it's about, it's a documentary called The Last Laugh, which deals with humor and the Holocaust. I then feel the need that the next sentence is, I understand that you very rarely hear those two words in the same sentence, but trust me. And I tell about Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and all the people who give testimony, but I also feel the need to go one step further and said it follows at its spine a 92-year-old survivor, Renee Firestone, is that her name?
Yes.
Renee Firestone, who tells us that they needed a sense of humor to survive the camps. And it's almost like I have felt the need as a defensive measure, okay,
yeah,
to qualify it. Hey, she says it's okay, so we can too.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know?
She even talks about a meeting with Joseph Mengele, the notorious German SS officer, Nazi physician, who operated on people without anesthesia, and she talks about it in comical terms.
Yeah, that's her sort of bent in life. You know, she has a very dark sense of humor, and that is part of her spirit.
And there's also a scene with Renee at a Holocaust survivors convention where she discusses her conscious decision to be happy after surviving the concentration camps.
That really got to me. That. The fact that she made this choice, I mean, because, you know, you look at the other survivor who is in the film, who is miserable. And, you know, apparently her life was miserable before the camps. So she wasn't a happy person to begin with. But, you know, we're talking about humor in the Holocaust, and humor in general is a coping mechanism. You know, for all of us, every comedian has used it as a coping mechanism. And I think the Jews in general have used comedy as a coping mechanism.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, whenever I'm asked, when I give any kind of speech and there's the Q&A afterwards,
right,
and if that question, which is inevitable,
yes, why are
pops
there
up,
so many,
so many Jews in comedy and this and that. And I think it's, aside from the obvious, it's a state of mind.
Yes.
And
is it laughing to keep from crying?
It's a little bit of that. It's also,
I believe. I do. My mother always said that. You know,
yeah,
if we weren't laughing, we'd be crying.
Yeah. And so what other choice do you have? And it's funny because I feel exactly the same way you do with that woman that Renee in the movie is friends with. Renee is all about not only looking at it and laughing, but she also has a philosophy about it. If I basically go through my life the way you do, this sad
right.
woman who's got this cloud over her, Hitler won.
Right.
Okay? I want to take back my life.
Right.
This is the only, you know, this is the only weapon that I have is to be happy.
Absolutely true.
Just let me tell people who they're listening to. My guests are veteran comedy writer Alan Zweibel, comedian Judy Gold, and also Fern Perlstein, who is the writer and director of a new documentary called The Last Laugh, which opens this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas.
Judy? You know, Alan mentioned that it's who we are. It's the way we think. And I believe it begins, this whole thought process, because when you look at a joke is a surprise. A joke is looking at something from a perspective that no one, you know, thought of. And that's what Jews do. I mean, you go to Brooklyn now, they're all studying the same Talmud that they've been studying for thousands of years, trying to find another angle.
But is it also the angle they take, for example, during World War II, Charlie Chaplin, Jack Benny, the Marx Brothers, even the Three Stooges made fun of Hitler and the Nazis. But audiences had problems with the great dictator at the time.
Mm-hmm. We're making fun of Putin. Not
SNL
that
has a shirtless every week. Just
yes. Yes. I think that it's a way of, you know, it is the zeitgeist, and it was the zeitgeist then. So I think... You know, how else you have to sort of break these people down to the one bit of, you know, the essence of them that is comedic that you can make fun of.
You know, it's interesting growing up, and when I was growing up in my home, there were two words that were always whispered. They were never said out loud. It was as if you said them out loud, you know, you gave them too much power. One was cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Jewish home I was brought up in, it was, she's a divorcee. Okay. And you go, whoa, that's pretty bad, because you say it with the same intonation you do cancer. But when I was born in 1950, so that means during the 50s, the Holocaust was still news.
Yes.
It was fresh in everybody's minds. So when I'd go to Hebrew school, or when my grandparents would come over, this was something that it was a two-hander. It was one, you had to have respect for it because look what happened. But at the other hand, it was never forget. And I think what happens now. And I think that a lot of the discussion groups that I've been a part of after screenings of your movie, Fern, is at this point, so many years later after the liberation, I think that this is very helpful in terms of keeping, this is to the deniers out there, keeping the idea and the notion that, yeah, this actually happened. The world went through this alive, you know.
And you look at kids who are born now, they will never meet a Holocaust survivor. You know, we have all met Holocaust survivors. These kids that are being born now will never know.
But they'll see them in reruns because Robert Clary, who was a camp survivor, went on to star in Hogan's Heroes. He says that his ability to sing saved his life in the camps.
Well, yeah. So he
and the Nazis liked the Jews who could do good cabaret.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can tell that, you know, he was singing, but I'm sure he was also joking around because that's his nature. He was young. If he hadn't had that skill, I think he would have been murdered along with all the other kids his age. So because he was the personality he was, it definitely kept him alive.
I mean, it's disarming. Comedy is disarming. You know, when you're funny, even if you have opposing political views, people say, oh, I kind of like that guy. I kind of like that girl. You know, she made me laugh. And you look at people, they want to make people laugh.
But I have to tell you, the late Joan Rivers, who I adored and who was a great guest on the show, whenever I had her on, I'd get some email from people saying, she hates women, she hates this, she hates that. Why would you put her on your show?
She was the nicest, kindest, classiest woman. It's a joke. And I think that you can discuss subversive topics in humor. I think you can make it's a palatable way to make a very important point.
Absolutely. I mean, it dates all the way back to Swift, in terms of parody, in terms of satire. And it's a way of, hanging a lantern on certain topics that ordinarily are whispered. You know, it's get it out there. And whether it's somebody like Lenny Bruce, you know, or Joan Rivers or anyone who stirred the pot. You look at Dick Gregory. I mean, you can go back. There were certain people who did those things and people were talking about it afterwards and it was out there as opposed to whispered.
Although sometimes people paid a price, and we'll come back to that and other things after we take a little break. My guests are Fern Perlstein, who's the writer and director of a new documentary called The Last Laugh, which opens this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema, and two of the people featured in the film, Judy Gold and Alan Zweibel. Stay with us for more. We're back with Fern Perlstein, writer and director of a new film called The Last Laugh, which opens this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and comedian Judy Gold and comedy writer Alan Zweibel, who has been known to tell a few jokes on his own as well. And The Last Laugh, we were talking about the film is about breaking taboos and what constitutes acceptable humor. I was thinking about what happened to Gilbert Gottfried when he tweeted what was considered rather unacceptable by Aflac anyway, jokes about the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. He was dropped by Aflac, and now they have somebody else doing the same voice that he gave them. Was the topic considered taboo, or was the fact that Aflac is an insurance company a factor?
I think they were based there, and I have to say the jokes were hilarious.
They were hilarious.
But he did it immediately.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
it was in seconds.
Yes.
You know, wait an hour, you know.
Yeah.
Let it breathe just a little bit. And I think that whenever a company drops you, I know this sounds like a blanket statement. It, on an individual basis, a lot of times it's a PR move. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I believe it's like to protect ourselves. We don't endorse this, although we're laughing as just like
right.
you are. You know, we don't endorse this and get rid of this. You know?
Well, we come to that whole issue of political correctness, which has been used a lot by conservatives to complain about what they consider to be correct or incorrect. And usually in their case, the things that they complain about is making jokes about women or not always jokes, in fact. But is this a political correctness situation? Or is it just a matter of you went too far? You really hurt people.
I think it's a combination.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I think that, you know, when you work for a corporation, and as you know, corporations are people, too.
There are all sorts of things I can't say on the air.
Yeah, right. And I think that when you're beholden to that, especially, you know, as a comedian, if you do a gig for a certain company, I've often been handed, you know, rules. You know, don't say this, don't mention that, don't mention that. And since I'm me, I usually bring them up and mention them. Just so you know, I'm not going to be doing this, or this. But, yeah, it's I think it's a combination, absolutely.
Now, Fern, you include a clip of Sacha Baron Cohen, who's Jewish, in his role as Borat, in a bar singing a song about throwing Jews down a well.
Yes.
The patrons laugh and sing along, but we see African-American comedians using certain words that the rest of us will not use. Does it matter who's telling the joke as to whether a joke is acceptable or not?
I think unless it's told really, really well and you're, you know, yes. I think that for people listening to the jokes, they're very uncomfortable if, you know, a non-Jewish person makes a Holocaust joke. But if they do, like, I can imagine, you know, a comedian doing it and doing it really well. You know, Ricky Gervais makes, you know, Holocaust jokes, and they're very funny, and he gets away with it. I think it has to do with, you know, the context, the delivery, and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, like also because he's British and nobody knows what he's
right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, he can say anything in British and we just think, oh, wow, that's very learned. Yeah, that's very erudite.
Well, Alan, you've worked with Larry David. It's interesting the different approaches that were taken toward the subjects of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust on Seinfeld and on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Well, look.
Was that because one was a network television show and the other was HBO?
I don't know specifically for sure, but I think once again, if you are on a cable station, you do have more leeway. It's as opposed to if you're on a broadcast network. I also think, you know, look, you build on what you can do, what you've done in the past. I know when I was with SNL, we were able to do more the 10th show than we could the first, and more the 100th than we could with the 10th. You slowly expand parameters, okay?
Although that hasn't happened recently because the political situation is such that everybody just expects SNL to go right to the limit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but I'm going back to, you know, 40 years,
yeah.
42 years. Now the landscape has changed. All I'm saying is that if you build look, it's like anything else. Even socially, if somebody tells a joke, you'll laugh, and if somebody else tells a joke, you're offended by it.
Right.
It's
but
who's telling it.
But you have to earn it. The thing is, you know, Larry could never have had that show unless he had, you know, earned his stripes doing Seinfeld. At that point, everyone trusted him. I think it's really a matter of, I trust you.
You know, on Larry, there was one episode in Curb where he was talking to someone and was lamenting the fact that somebody in his life died 9/11, and the other person in the scene, you know, reacted sort of appropriately. Oh, you mean in the Twin Towers? And he said, no, he was riding his bicycle on 10th Avenue up to 57th Street and got hit by a bus on 9/11. And it was really funny because and that was great joke writing.
Right.
It faked one direction, went another, and because it was out of the character. So it was the confluence of all of those things that made us laugh.
Yeah.
Somebody else, you know, you know.
If you didn't know Larry, then it wouldn't be funny coming out of another human being's mouth.
Well, we interview a woman, Roz Weinman, who she was the head of standards and practices for NBC during the Seinfeld years, and talked about with us how there, you know, what she would approve for Seinfeld or even Saturday Night Live was different than what she would have approved for another 8 p.m. show. Because you
for
have
Friends
to,
or something.
Right.
Or, yeah, or something more, you know, even more family related, where, you know, she knows the audience, she knows what they have tolerance for, and that's taken into consideration with some of this stuff.
Well, the rules have changed there as well. Ed Sullivan couldn't put a mixed doo-wop group on his show at one point because there were objections from some stations in the South.
He also changed the lyrics to a Rolling Stones song where he had them say, let's spend some time together as opposed to let's spend the night together.
Yeah.
Okay, so look how far we've come.
Yeah.
What role does the sophistication of the audience play in terms of what kinds of jokes work and what jokes don't? Because you, as Judy, you as somebody who's doing stand-up, I suspect you look out at the audience and say, you know, I don't think
you
certain jokes are going
to
work with these guys.
Yeah, it's interesting as you travel. If you're close to an urban area, usually they're more hip. They're more, I dare say, well-read or just more knowledgeable about the world. And then there are those little pockets of where people have said, I can't take my life in this city anymore, and I'm going to go here. And you're so surprised that in this remote area, there's a bunch of, you know, hippies or you know, intellectuals who just wanted to, you know, get away. And those are also fantastic.
Well, Lenny Bruce used to do a routine about, I think it was going to Cincinnati, and there was this Jewish family that knew he was Jewish, and they welcomed him to their home and all the rest. And he found it annoying.
Right.
Because It had nothing to do with whether they thought he was a good comic or anything.
Right.
It had simply to do with the fact that,
he was a
Jew who had wandered from New York into Cincinnati.
Right, right. Yeah.
Now, Fern, can you speak a bit about the controversy that surrounds the film from 1988, Life is Beautiful, which won an Oscar for Best Foreign Film, won Roberto Benigni an Oscar for Best Actor. Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League says he loved that film, and Mel Brooks says it's the worst film ever made. He would have thought it would be the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, but in my, you know, in the process of making this film, I have found that most survivors I've spoken to really don't like the film. It really alienates them. And most of the comedians that I spoke to didn't like the film. So in that way, it's not a coincidence. When you hear Abe Foxman's story, which I think is really incredibly moving, how he related to the story because his, you know, parents gave him away to save him, and he can find something to relate to. I thought, you know, that's an incredibly beautiful story. So, you know, that's how it touched him personally. And it is just subjective. All of, you know, like what jokes we like, it's totally subjective. And I think it's just ironic in the film because, you know, there are other things that you hear that Abe Foxman doesn't agree with. And suddenly, you know, in the film, it seems that the comedians don't like Life is Beautiful. And then he's on the other side of that. And it's sort of a coincidence.
That's, I think, you know, it's called a sense of humor. And, you know, your sense of, you know, your sense of taste is different than someone else. I believe it's that innate, a sense of humor.
And you were mentioning earlier that comics tend to be more tolerant of jokes that other people might find a little
too much. Yeah.
But are there ever times when a comic tells you a joke, you say, ooh,
no.
We say ooh a lot, but laughing through the ooh.
Right,
You know, it's, I've never heard a joke on any subject which is considered taboo where I said, I can't speak to you anymore.
Right, okay? right, yeah.
Don't call me. Lose my number.
That's
never happened. Yeah. But I
mean,
have
jokes
gone
about rape or disfigurement and things like that. They,
well,
and people
everything.
Make those kinds of jokes.
To one another, but never. Right.
That's taken the place of whispering just like divorcee. Okay, that's the new divorcee. It's, I think among ourselves, if we go into those areas, I think we're testing the waters.
Yeah.
You're taking the temperature just a little bit. And we all censor each other in a way. But by and large, I think it's about the mechanics of joke writing and joke
telling.
You know?
And also, there's so many times where you think, oh, I wish I had thought of that.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean,
so
I worked with
times.
Gary Shandling for years, and he would call me up in the middle of the night with the most vile kinds of things about dates a date he had the night before. And I go, oh, man. And not only would I be laughing, I would very soon forgive him for waking me up at 5 o'clock in the morning because I'm marveling. If I lived to be 1,000, I could not have written that joke.
Right, right.
Hmm. I did love Gary Shandling, but he never told those kinds of jokes on his television shows.
No, he didn't do it on Larry Sanders. And the show that I did with him, it's Gary Shandling's show, we never did either. But once the camera was off, my God. But once again, it was not for the sake of shocking as much as there was a kind of the craftsmanship. And God, I wish I can tell them now, but I couldn't because...
Well, it's not 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, well, might wait until 5 o'clock. We'll come back. And,
it is
and
for
I'll,
comics,
and I'll say,
actually.
Yes.
You can say things on the air in the middle of the night that you can't say right now.
Yeah. Like I said, I'll be back. If you want, I'll bring dinner.
Okay. I had real problems with the Larry Sanders show because I thought he was revealing too much about how talk shows work.
It
was,
right.
You know, usually they get it all wrong. He got it all right.
Well, you know, he for so many years, he was the guest host of The Tonight Show beforehand. And so he knew the mechanics of it. And I remember when we finished our show, it's Gary Shandling's show, we had dinner one night. And he said that, I believe it was Fox, had offered him his own talk show. And during the course of the dinner, when he asked, what do you think? I remember saying to him, I said, I believe you'll get bored. Knowing you, the writer you are, and the way you look at the world, I said, if anything, turn it on its side. Look at, play that guy. Don't be that guy. And I'm sure everybody told him that. Gary was one of those people who asked you something in confidence, and then you found out he asked about 200 people the same thing in confidence. Absolutely. He was just a keen observer, as is Larry David, mm-hmm. of what humans do, and takes a little thing and makes a meal out of it.
Right.
Now, Fern, earlier we mentioned Renee Firestone, the Holocaust survivor who makes jokes, but in a couple of different points in your film, we see her watching clips of comedians with her daughter, Clara, and most of the clips, including those of Sarah Silverman, she doesn't find funny. So yeah. How much of this is a generational thing as opposed to being, whether it's something that deals with you personally?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is a generational thing. But, I don't think it's a black and white issue. I mean, Renee is somebody with a sense of humor, like Judy says. But that doesn't mean that a joke about, Sarah Silverman tells about her grandmother's tattoo saying bedazzled is going to make a Holocaust survivor laugh, you know? So, the reason I wanted to film her watching those things is because I wanted that level of context. And I had seen Sarah do that show early days on Bleecker Street with a lot of young people, and it was hilarious. But when I was filming Renee watching those same jokes, suddenly I felt sick.
Have we changed in the way we respond to people pushing the envelope? I mean, Sarah Silverman's a star. Lenny Bruce was arrested any number of times while he was doing his act, and it was often because he made jokes about religion and other things that were then considered taboo, and police departments objected to them. Sometimes he used words that now just could be said on the Bill Maher show.
Right. I mean, when you
more
look
often
at,
than you might even want.
When you look at tapes now of him, it's mind-boggling that he was put in jail for that.
I mean, but was he the responsible, do you think? Because nobody else was doing it at that time. So many comics came along after him.
Right, and copied him.
And were influenced.
Yes, and I mean, look at George Carlin, too. He changed his entire act. But yes, it takes one person to sort of eat it for everyone else.
I think you're absolutely right. It takes one person to say, I'm going to try that. And,
right.
and then all of a sudden, there's resistance. But another person says, that's not bad. And then it becomes a thing. And if you look at I always find it fascinating to look at these things within the context of the times that they're either delivered
right.
or performed or acted out, mm-hmm. If you talk to, I had read interviews with Groucho Marx. We look at Duck Soup, for example, which I think was 1939, and it was the war between Sylvania and Fredonia, and it was hilarious, okay? And everyone said to him, didn't this represent, what was going on in Europe at the time, and it was just at the brink of the Second World War? And he says, we're just trying to be funny,
right.
So it's also what the audience brings to something. They have a responsibility in this relationship.
But as I said in the film, I think that if you're going to make a joke about a huge, horrible tragedy, it's got to be a good joke. It's got to be a really, really good joke.
Well, I still think they read differently.
Yeah.
The Great Dictator reads differently today, to be or not to be, with Jack Benny, which I think is just a brilliant movie.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, people were troubled by it.
Right.
Because it was making fun of the Nazis.
And he came out to say that had he known the extent of what went on, he wouldn't have made the film.
Mm-hmm. Now, a number of listeners have called in to because they want to know why nobody seems to like Life is Beautiful other than Abe Foxman.
It's unfair because it just, as it turns out, like I said, most survivors I've spoken to don't like it, and most comedians. But I don't think, I mean, clearly people love that film. It won the Academy Award. There are plenty of people that love it. And so it just so happens that who I interviewed. Mm-hmm. Didn't.
It's interesting. I I'm going to want to watch that movie again,
yeah, me
knowing
too.
This, okay? Because I remember seeing it back then and thought it was a fairy tale. I thought it was this fable that happened
yes.
in the most dire circumstance in most settings. And here was this father trying to make his kid smile and everything's going to be okay. And I accepted it for that.
I totally agree with you.
I did
you
too.
Know. You
people
know,
felt
and
it trivialized the Holocaust.
Yeah, I now understand that, but I just watched it at the time for what it was. And so that's why I'd like to look at it again.
But you know, when I've watched it recently,
yeah.
after having seen it when it came out, it seemed completely tame by today's
it's
standards.
It's harmless. It is it's harmless.
Well, you can all go off and watch it right now because we've come to the end of this segment. I've been speaking with Fern Perlstein, the writer and director of The Last Laugh, which opens this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and two of its contributors, Judy Gold and Alan Zweibel. It's been a great pleasure having you on our
Thank
show.
Thanks
for having
Thank
us.
You so much.
And I'll be back at 5 a.m. so I can tell
yeah.
you that joke.
Oh, can I co-host?
You bet.
All right.